The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first article today is entitled, The Problem America Cannot Fix. The public supports many sensible gun measures, but flaws in our democracy make us unable to adopt them. By John J. Donahue. The deadliest acts of mass murder in the United States since 9/11 all share one feature. The killer in every case used an assault-style weapon or a firearm equipped with a high-capacity magazine. This was the case last week at a shooting at a Kentucky bank that killed five, and in recent shooting at an elementary school in Nashville that killed six, including 3 9-year-old children. And yet, the country has failed to adopt the policies needed to keep these weapons out of the hands of those who would abuse them. At the most obvious level, mass shootings are a serious and worsening problem that imposes substantial burdens on the public. But they are something else as well, a national disgrace that illuminates the inability of the American political system to adopt numerous popular public policy strategies that together could substantially reduce the prevalence and destructiveness of these events. One of these measures, the federal assault weapons ban, was in place for a decade, but it was allowed to lapse in 2004. The gun lobby is challenging every valuable gun safety law throughout the United States with the belief that Republican appointees on the Supreme Court will protect the right to sell lethal weaponry to as many Americans as possible. I have been studying the links between guns and crime for the past quarter century and have written numerous econometric studies examining both the extent to which permissive gun laws in America increase violent crime and the mechanisms through which these laws translate into significant social harm. In addition to publishing dozens of articles based on this research, I have also provided expert declarations, reports, and testimony in at least 20 cases in which the gun industry was trying to thwart gun control efforts such as restrictions on assault weapons and high-capacity magazines, gun carrying outside the home and in sensitive places, and requirements that guns be safely stored. Over and over, what I have seen is how the pernicious and pervasive influence of the gun lobby blocks or undermines any remotely sensible approach to dealing with America's problems of gun violence, which is unique among affluent nations. What is the gun lobby's response to the horrific curse of mass shootings? Any hope that harsher punishment, the preferred alternative to gun control, would deter aspiring killers is nonsensical, given the already draconian penalty a mass shooter will face, not to mention the high rate at which they die on the scene, gunned down by police or felled by suicide. The 18-year-old Buffalo shooter from last May, who killed 10 people using the same weapon as the Sandy Hook shooter, a Bushmaster XM-15 semi-automatic rifle, had written, "I am well aware that my actions will effectively ruin my life. If I'm not killed during the attack, I will go to prison for an inevitable life sentence." The gun lobby has a counterintuitive and self-serving suggestion for dealing with the proliferation of assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. More gun sales and more gun carrying, so that, quote, a good guy with a gun, end quote, can kill a mass shooter. Unfortunately, the best empirical evidence suggests that this will be a self-defeating policy, because the proliferation of guns will lead to more gun violence, resulting from increased gun thefts, more road rage violence, and diminished police effectiveness. The occasional episodes where a good guy with a gun thwarts a mass shooting will be offset by the growing parade of ills from what the then president of the National Rifle Association, testifying in support of a 1938 federal gun control act, called the inadvisable promiscuous toting of guns. Even Ronald Reagan once said that there is no reason why on the street today that a citizen should be carrying loaded weapons. Guns are a ridiculous way to solve problems that have to be solved among people of goodwill. Of course, many Americans do believe in expansive rights to gun ownership. But it's still the case that the political system is producing an outcome far more permissive than what the population wants. To begin with, repeated surveys show that while the NRA membership consistently supports reasonable measures such as universal background checks, NRA leaders stake out a much more extreme position. Following the February 2018 high school shooting at Parkland, Florida, that left 17 dead, then-President Donald Trump announced that we need more gun control and that he was not afraid of the NRA. But when the NRA head, Wayne LaPierre, told Trump to stop the push for universal background checks, then supported by 90% of the people who voted Republican in the 2018 midterm election, Trump stopped. Other countries have shown what is possible with decisive federal action. Australia had a worse mass shooting problem per capita than the United States before 1996, when a horrific mass shooting led the Conservative government to act. It greatly curtailed the problem by enacting a stringent restriction on semi-automatic rifles, enforced with a mandated gun buyback. Australia did not have to contend with a domestic gun industry as corrosively powerful as America's, which enabled it to adopt a more potent legislation than President Bill Clinton was able to secure with the assault weapons ban in 1994. Any approach that doesn't include a federal assault weapons ban with accompanying restrictions on high-capacity magazines will be inadequate. State bans on assault weapons and high-capacity magazines have helped, but killers have circumvented them, buying their weapons in neighboring gun-friendly states. Similarly, removing the huge loopholes in the federal background check system would ameliorate things, but its minimal level of screening needs to be buttressed extensively. The FBI's analysis of 55 active shooters over age 18 found that 65% had no adult convictions prior to the active shooting event. In other words, most mass shooters who are old enough to buy an assault weapon are what the Supreme Court opinion in Bruin last summer referred to as law-abiding responsible citizens when they acquired their weapons of mass murder. The characterization is, of course, absurd. Many mass murderers in America have had traits or behaviors that might have been the basis for removing their guns or prohibiting them from acquiring weapons in any strict regulatory regime. Indeed, no European government, nor any sensible person, would have had difficulty in realizing that the 19-year-old Parkland shooter should not have had access to any firearm, let alone an assault rifle. The same is true for the 18-year-old Uvalde shooter, who killed 21 people, and the 20-year-old Sandy Hook shooter, who killed 26. The troubling aspects of their behaviors were so apparent that typical European-style screening would have blocked their gun acquisitions. But in the U.S., where roughly 90% of the public supports universal background checks and supported by NRA members, in contrast to the NRA itself, the Republican Party will not stand up to the gun lobby's fears that such a measure would impair its profits by reducing gun sales. Again, all of this indicates rot in American democracy, which is thwarting the will of the people who do support these sensible measures. But beyond restrictions on weaponry and a more probing assessment of who is a law-abiding responsible citizen with Second Amendment right to a firearm, more public education is required to inform the citizenry of the dangers of allowing deeply disturbed individuals to have access to such lethal weaponry. Nancy Lanza's bizarre decision to keep assault rifles in the same home that her unstable son lived in was a deadly, avoidable error. The 21-year-old Highland Park killer from this past July 4th alarmed his family enough to alert police of his efforts to kill everyone, But only months later, his father endorsed his application for a firearm, another failure of both gun policy and citizen responsibility. The Sutherland Springs First Baptist Church killer of 26 people was another disturbed and previously violent individual living on his parents' estate. Yet they took no efforts to restrict his access to assault weapons. According to the testimony of FBI agents at his trial, he used an AR-15 modified to include a laser scope and features that would allow large capacity magazines to be more quickly reloaded to maintain a relentless barrage. He stood outside the church and fired straight through its walls as he strafed along just above the tops of the church pews, allowing him to shoot 254 times in a matter of minutes. No portable weapon in civilian hands at the time of the Second Amendment's adoption could have possibly generated this degree of destruction so rapidly. The social harms will only grow as technology increases firearm lethality, so greater restrictions are needed, backed by a far more searching governmental screening process and concerted efforts by parents and the public to keep such weaponry away from obviously dangerous. Remarkably, from today's vantage point at least, Texas banned carrying guns outside the home for protection from 1871 to 1995. As of June 2022, this would now be deemed unconstitutional under Bruin. Apparently, no one in Texas noticed this ostensible Second Amendment violation for 125 years. When it started down its pro-gun path, Texas had almost a 20% lower murder rate than California, and an only slightly higher murder rate than New York City. After 25 years of increasing gun restrictions in California and New York, Texas has seen an astonishing change. In 2021, the state had a 27% higher murder rate than California, and a 75% higher murder rate than New York. The Supreme Court seems to want to close those gaps by making California and New York as deadly as Texas. Referencing unpublished work by a supportive researcher, an NRA lawyer told the Supreme Court in the Bruin oral arguments that allowing more citizens to carry guns would have no impact on crime, ironically conceding that even the most pro-NRA assessment of the data showed no benefit from more gun carrying. The best peer review evidence, though, reaches a far more ominous conclusion concerning the march toward deregulation. Sadly, America's lead as the most homicidal affluent nation will only grow unless more fundamental reform to its gun policy is undertaken and the American people are allowed to have their say. Next, the not-so-secret key to emotional balance, by Arthur Brooks. This is from April 2023 edition. A dear friend of mine, whom I recently lost, spent most of his life near the Severn River in Maryland. The Severn is technically a tidal estuary, a brackish inlet off the Chesapeake Bay, where salt water mixes with fresh. It's the most human river, my friend once told me. It has the precise salinity of human tears. Whether or not the Severn is one, a river of pure tears sounds like a scene out of a Greek tragedy. But to my friend, it was a mystical and beautiful juxtaposition that a signature of sorrow would accompany the splendor of nature. Crying, too, is a contradiction. It can accompany the most profound grief or the deepest joy. It can be a response to anger and frustration or to poetry too lovely for words. As such, crying is often thought of as an expression of wild emotion, but this is yet another contradiction. In fact, crying can be a powerful tool to tame our feelings, to maintain a deep equanimity in our emotional life. It can bring balance, peace, and just maybe even a touch of the divine. Crying is very common and quintessentially human. Although many species call out our distress to signal a help, call out in distress to signal a help, a need for help, only humans weep with tears for emotional reasons and not because of ocular irritation. As the Dutch psychologist Ad Fingerhoots had chronicled in his research, two negative crying triggers are extremely consistent across populations and cultures: helplessness and loss. Occasionally, though, we weep for joy. Scholars find it perplexing because it seems counterintuitive that we would respond to overwhelmingly positive emotions with a negative expression. New research conducted in several countries found that happy crying tends to occur during four occasions: times of extraordinary affection, such as weddings, 55% of positive crying on average; moments of unusual achievement, such as winning an award, 29%, awe in the face of beauty, such as exquisite music, 8%, and intense amusement, 3%. Classifying it, though, doesn't seem to make it any more logical. There may be, in fact, a deeper connection between happy crying and sad crying. They are both a response to emotional extremes, which suggests that tears bring us back to equilibrium. Overwhelming negative emotion is important, even life-saving, in a crisis like being separated from loved ones or being under threat. It creates the impulse to act with force or immediacy. But staying in this state isn't helpful beyond the immediate crisis, nor is it pleasant. So we seek to reduce stress and improve our mood, which crying can do quite effectively. Some researchers argue that we also need to reset emotionally when things are just too wonderful. Overwhelming joy feels great, but it distracts us from the business of life, and ongoing rapture would be exhausting. The exact mechanism for how crying keeps extreme emotions in check has not been definitively established. Some researchers have posited that there's literal truth to the Jewish proverb, "What soap is for the body, tears are for the soul." In his book, Crying, The Mystery of Tears, the biochemist William H. Fry hypothesized that we eliminate stress hormones, such as cortisol, through tears. Another less widely accepted theory is that tears clear blood of certain toxins or unwanted chemicals. Emotional balance is good for the well-being. Though strong feelings are inevitable, having excessive and persistent emotional highs and lows is clearly not associated with good mental health. People who experience dysregulated emotions, positive and negative, are sometimes said to have cyclothymic disorder, a mood disorder that lowers the quality of life. Crying is not a cure-all, of course. Weeping involuntarily, for example at work, can lead to embarrassment, which is unlikely to make you happier. This is especially true for men, probably due to stigma, and people with high inconscientiousness who dislike burdening others. In such a situation, you might seek to avoid feelings of shame by preventing crying. Folk cures include pushing your tongue into the roof of your mouth, trying to relax your face, and pinching yourself. Better yet, you might avoid the pinches and still get the emotional release of crying by surrounding yourself with people who won't think less of you for shedding a few tears. Or if possible, consider finding a job that doesn't drive you to weeping. Evolutionary biology sheds light on the scientific mystery of human tears, but there remains a deep mystery in crying. Otherwise, my friend's observation about the Severn would be about as lyrical as saying it was a river of sneezes. Crying is central to religious iconography, to mythology, to profound transcendental experiences. For example, the shortest verse in most English translations of the Christian Bible is, "Jesus wept," describing his response when his close friend Lazarus died. The point here does not seem like Jesus was trying to restore his emotional equilibrium. Usually, the verse is seen as a sign of God's solidarity with humanity, like the touch of the fingertips of God and man on the ceiling of Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel. Just we were made in God's image. He fashions himself in ours, coming to earth to experience both our joys and our sorrows. The quintessentially human experience of crying may be our most divine one as well. Our third article for today is from the ideas section. The problem with retirement age is that it's too high. The richest society in human history should prioritize earlier eligibility for Social Security. By Annie Lowry. As France is racked by furious protests over President Emmanuel Macron's plans for pension cuts, a bipartisan group of legislators on Capitol Hill is discussing how to make Social Security available to a smaller group of workers. People are living longer, the argument goes, and benefit programs are running out of money. Shifting the retirement age higher is a reasonable, desirable, and necessary fix. Except it is not reasonable, it is not desirable, and it is not necessary. Indeed, the opposite is true. Politicians should let Americans retire with security and dignity by making retirement benefits more generous and by promising to lower the retirement age. Lifting the age at which retirees can receive their full Social Security benefits is one of those policies that sounds sober and prudent on the face of it. The Congressional Budget Office projects that the Social Security Trust Fund will run out of money 10 years from now, in part because current beneficiaries got such a large cost of living adjustment this year. The ostensibly obvious solution is to have Americans work a little longer before they can access their full benefits, something that will help the country avoid turning into Japan, where productivity and GDP have sagged as the elderly make up a larger share of the population. In reality, raising the retirement age is the fetishistic obsession of a tiny sliver of Beltway wonks, people wholly out of step with what average Americans want and need. There is more than one way to keep the United States from turning into Japan. One is to admit millions of additional immigrants, something proven to increase the number of startups and help the rate of economic growth. The U.S. could also establish a child allowance and a rational paid leave policy to help families that want more kids. Similarly, there is more than one way to fix Social Security's eventual financing challenges. Right now, the payroll tax that raises money for the program applies only to the first $160,200 of a person's wage income. If you make $300,000 a year, $139,800 of that money remains untouched by the relevant tax. This is unfair. There's no good reason that millionaires should pay a lower tax rate than their assistants do to help finance the country's retirement benefits. And there's no reason to make the tax liability max out, even if benefits do. We want progressive taxes and progressive spending. It is also silly, given the importance of Social Security in ending elderly poverty and let people retire with confidence. Lifting the payroll tax cap would secure the program's financing for decades, depending on wage and longevity trends. Those longevity trends do not really show all Americans enjoying a long and healthy life. In 1980, 50-year-olds in the top income quintile could expect to live 4 to 5 years longer than 50-year-olds in the bottom income quintile. In 2010, the rich were living 13 to 14 years longer than the poor. And now the average life expectancy is dropping because of the coronavirus pandemic, the opioid epidemic, and the prevalence of gun violence. The number of healthy years that lower-income Americans can expect to enjoy by the time they hit middle age is also lower than you might think. What some researchers call the health span, meaning the length of time a person spends living without major illness or disability is heavily predicated on a person's socioeconomic status. The rich get to retire and have fun. The poor have to go work until their body starts to give out. The people arguing that Americans should work until they are 70 are typically people with cushy, remunerative, white-collar jobs, the type of jobs that are fun and intellectually engaging for octogenarians. Most people do not have those jobs, especially not older workers without a college degree. That's why the average lower-income American quits working and applies for Social Security as soon as they are eligible, trading a lower monthly benefit for the ability to stop changing car tires or working at a cash register for $11 an hour at age 62. That is perhaps the strongest argument for lowering the retirement age rather than raising it. Earlier retirement is what the American people obviously want, given how they behave. Poll after poll after poll shows that both Democrats and Republicans strongly support leaving benefits alone. And survey after survey shows that older Americans seek retirement as soon as it is as is practical, with one-third of people taking benefits at age 62, and more than half accepting reduced benefits for the chance to quit working before the full retirement age of 66. There is no good reason for the government to force such people to continue toiling away at their job toward the end of their life. We live in the wealthiest society the world has ever known. We have dozens of policy options available to increase employment among prime-age workers, help all Americans live a healthier life, and lift productivity and GDP. It would be straightforward to fully finance Social Security with some simple tax changes, ones that would have the benefit of making the tax code fairer and more progressive. And it would be straightforward to give workers what they want by letting them accept full retirement benefits at age 62 or 65 rather than at age 67. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, and have a great day.